From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andrew Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools. And so the first thing we want to do is call out some of the people who have been writing us. We've been getting a lot of email.
Yeah, lots and lots. About lots of different things, too. Just a quick shout-out to Walkman and John and Dwayne and who else do I have on my phone here?
Charles.
Charles Tor, yeah. Larry, no. Bob Snyder, Rui Bastos, I probably ruined your name there. Tony... Joe, Patterson, Brad, Andre, that's Magic Andre.
Nice, Magic Andre 1981.
Yeah, he found a good bug the other day, so I got that
he
logged.
He tends to do that.
Yep.
Well, that's a good forum, or
Mark
posts in the show notes as well as emails.
Yeah, Mark, Luson, lots. So, we get
excellent.
A lot.
So, if someone wants to write, can they only write about this show?
No, Larry. They can ask about any show or excellent. Any other issue, really, because it gives us ideas to what to do in the future.
Yeah, write us about anything. Tell us about your old TRS-80 Model 3 that doesn't run anymore.
And it doesn't have to be a question either. It can be feedback, right? Say, delve into this deeper. Hey, stop doing all these side stories about GW Basic, like I did last week.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Everybody loves that.
Nobody complained about that. Everybody loved that. But, tell us to keep on track if we're kind of... skewing a bit. Just give us feedback. We're actually nearly at the end of the WinDBG series for our user mode. This will be the last user mode one. We'll do more just how to set up the kernel debugger next week. And then we're going to quickly go over kernel and then we're off into other things. So there's been a fair few people kind of saying, hey, when we're doing next thing? Well, it's very soon.
Almost there. Excellent. What are we talking about today?
We're finishing off synchronization objects. We're going to skew a little bit into weightable objects. The last two we have are semaphores and mutexes. Chad.
How long have we worked together, man?
Chad talked about mutexes a bit. When was that?
Months ago.
Yeah. So we're going to very quickly go over that again. And then just to fill out the show, we're going to go over timers. And why things like Media Center is a good example, how it can actually wake your machine up to tape a TV show. So we'll go into that. And that's a good segue into the kernel because there's close to zero information in the user mode. So we actually have to look at a kernel dump to get the second half of everything. So as always, I've written a lot of demos for today.
Excellent.
A couple people have asked for it. So I've just been emailing it out. Can we put it on the show as a downloadable?
Is that absolutely.
Possible? So yeah, there's a
thing called SkyDrive. Ah. We'll stick it up there and link to it.
Cool. So we'll have a zip file of every single program I've written, and then you can go for your life. Where are we? Demo apps. Hold down shift so you get the command prompt thingy. I'll get a second one for proc dump. So the first one we're going to do is semaphores. So that's just run this program and see what it does. So what we have is an application that creates a semaphore and creates a quit event. Same as last week, it makes a whole lot of worker threads. This time it's making 5 instead of 3 just so it goes through the work faster. The thing about a semaphore is it's like slots. You can have as many as you declare in create semaphore. In this case, I said it has 10 slots. And then what I did is I woke up 8 slots. And so you end up with 8 queued events to be, or 8 queued triggerings to do. Because there's 5 threads waiting on that guy, the first 5 all are satisfied and they all run. And there's still 3 left over. When they finish, they go back into waiting and then immediately are satisfied because there's still residual signaling to do. So 3 more happen, which is these 3 here, and then they all go back to waiting. And then finally I've got some code that after 30 seconds the program times out and the quit event fires. So let's get a dump file in the middle here. So we're between when 5 are satisfied and 3 are still remaining. Use proc dump as always. Is it called semaphore? All right, so what we're going to do is let this run. Whoops. And then right now, what this has done is caught in the middle where 5 have been satisfied. They were all on a 5-second sleep, just so that the thing doesn't roll around really fast. Start dot. And so let's have a look at this guy. Tilde star K, just to get a quick, my machine's taking off again. So this is the first main thread that made everybody. He's now sleeping, waiting for, in 30 seconds, he's going to shut down the program. And then you've got the five workers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, they're also all on sleeps because the wait is satisfied so fast, I'm not going to get a dump. So it's on their thing. But what we can see is the semaphore. And so nobody's waiting on it. So there's no handle to go looking for in this case, right? And you tend to see this in semaphores where if there's pending work, nobody's actually waiting for it. It's just queued up. So what we want to do is find the semaphore. And it's a bit brute force. We just have to go bang handle, and you know, there's a semaphore in this table, so I'm going to be really cheeky and just do a find. Oh. Hmm. There it is, 34. So this is kind of where you're limited. Much like last week, we can put a flag on the end and explode our additional information. In this case, we one of the bits, I think it's bit 4 or something, gives us a name. I named this one. Once again, we can go into Win over J and see it. And then it would be under Sessions. Actually, I need to run as administrator. Sessions 1, in this case, base name objects. And it would be in here like it was last week. It won't be there right now because the program ended. Unfortunately, this doesn't have any specific information, which I think is the last bit in the flag, the 8-bit. We actually don't know how many are pending, right? So we don't know that those three are outstanding right now.
You don't know that there's 10 slots or that...
None of that stuff. Yeah. So if you have a kernel dump of this or a live debug, would you be able to see in the kernel dump as well? I'm assuming you would.
Then some way to find it, sure.
Yeah. You may or may not need private symbols. Maybe, anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
The point is, you're kind of stuck here, and that's one of the annoying things about semaphores is that we don't really have a good experience with them. Semaphores are used a little bit. I know that the ESE engine, the Extensible Storage Engine, better known as Jet Engine, so that Microsoft Access.
Yeah.
Back in whenever it was, years ago, they actually split the Jet Engine, and there's Jet Blue and Jet Red. And I think I'm right in saying that Microsoft Access runs Jet Red, and everybody else who uses the same engine, the same Jet engine, which actually is called ESE now, uses the Jet Blue variant. Who are using it? Well, more people than you think. Well, the whole Exchange is based on it, for starters. The ACP, Active Directory, Search. Nearly every major service that Microsoft writes that needs a database underneath it actually has ESE in it. And I'm not going to go bother finding a dump file for this, but if you did looked at all the weighable objects, you will see a lot of people waiting on semaphores. It uses the semaphore design pattern a lot. It actually uses the semaphore and then moves on to events a lot too, so it kind of interchanges between the two.
As a user, I just know the name from having a semaphore error, which as a user, I didn't know what that meant at the time.
It's really an event, really. It's just like a queue of events. It's like, you know, whatever, I'm just going to trigger this event 10 times and queue it up. So it changes it from this Boolean type idea to, I have eight times I'm going to open the door, queued up. I don't know what the metaphor in real life is for that. But
it's like the doorman who's standing there going like, okay, 8 of you can go in now.
Right? I've got 8 packages to get in the door. Can you open the door 8 times for me when I arrive and I'm ready for it or something?
It's really more of an optimization of an event because you could kind of do the same thing with an event, but you'd have to call set event 8 times in a loop where...
But you also have to wait for it to unsignal.
And wait for it. And it's much more efficient to just have a semaphore in that case and go, hey, just signal 8 of these guys.
Yeah. So that's really semaphores. There's not really that much you can look at. I mean, it's one of those unfortunate ones which doesn't have the best experience. Let's look at the next one, mutexes. I nearly typed .cls then. I was just at that point. So a mutex, I made a program called Single Instance because that's what it's used for a lot. So what this program does is... my demo at... Oh, I hate how you got to put a quote on it. And so you can see that on the first one, this top one, I made a named mutex, which means it's once again in WinObj. And actually, because we're running right now, I can go into here, press F5 for refresh, and there's my mutex. Notice in here it's called mutant. I got tripped up by that last week. A lot of programs will say mutant rather than mutex because under the covers in the kernel, the object that it created and associated with your handle table, which we talked about last week, is a mutant. And so what happens is I made a mutex and I made a auto reset event. When this guy, the second person, runs and we call create mutex, I gave it the name and it gives you back the handle, and the handle is perfectly valid, but it sets get last error to error already exists. And actually what we'll do is I'll take a dump file of this right now and we'll see, we'll see what we can see. This program, single threaded program, I didn't have any reason to have more than that. And he's just waiting for an event. And let's find out what he's doing and why he's waiting for an event. I'm guessing that 34 might be correct.
It's probably a handle. Yeah. Like we talked about last week, low number divisible by 4.
Yep. Now you can actually wait on a mutex, but it's more common that you find people wait on events. What you do is you make a named event, which is these ones we've been talking about in the global space. And then what you do is between two programs, you both open the object. And so in this case, what it did is there's another, and there's also a mutex in here. And once again, the debugger says mutant rather than mutex. And you can see the name of it. And you'll see that the process I dump, which is the one who's running, it actually has additional information and is owned by that guy. So you can work out ownership. So what happens is in the first process, it creates the mutex and the get last error comes back with hunky dory zero, everything's good. And there's a flag which you pass in, which is initial owner, and you'll find that most people set that to true. And what happens is you acquire it, and if you were able to open the object, which is a security thing, and you were able to, you were the first person there and took ownership, it will come back with zero. On the second program, you have the same line of code, but because initial owner is set to true, it lets you open the handle from a security point of view, but it comes back with a get last error saying error already exists. Which I think is described in here, put down here. So what that means to you is, yes, you have a valid handle, and if you wanted, you could fire the mutex waitable object, which if someone was waiting on it, it would fall through. What you tend to find, though, is people tend to make a named event as well and then use that to release it. I don't know why people tend to do it, but because mutex is completely capable of it. But what you do is you they make an event. So in this case, this guy is waiting on an event, which is a global one. The first one goes, hey, and let's look at the code. I should be able to. So we've got some code. So we'll go from the start, create the mutex, take ownership of it, and then look at the error. If it came back as zero, it means that we own it. We make an event, and then we just wait, we wait for that event to fire. And that's why you got this text here. So when the second one entered, the first program can detect that someone else wants to bring, say, you to the foreground. Right? It's just an event. It doesn't matter what you really do. If you want to bring yourself to the foreground, make some decision, whatever, that's up to you. But that's how you do the inter-process synchronization. And so when this comes back as, hey, I was fired, I put that on the screen and I said bring myself to the foreground. If the error came back as error already exists, I mean, you still have a handle to it and you could still fire it and various other things. In this case, instead of creating the event, I open the event and then I fire it. And so I just set the event. Pretty easy logic to follow. Unfortunately, when you look at dump files, it's not really that obvious, right? About all you can get to is ownership. But it's just still pretty cool. All right, so that's kind of mutexes. You have anything you want to say about mutexes, really?
No, I mean, when I've done them in the past for demos, I didn't create that separate event.
I mean,
I just rely on the mutex to signal me when it's released. So I'm not sure what the, like you said, what the reason is to create an event as well. But,
I think it's because programmers get into this idea because they write a lot of events, mm-hmm. and they must somehow in their brain want to be consistently just have an array of events,
right?
And they don't want to mix metaphors, maybe.
It could be stylistic thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but still set event no matter what you're doing. So yeah, it's just stylistically. Yeah. So we have both. I mean, both exist and both projects can be made. And so because I knew that was going to be kind of like a short episode, I decided that we should do one more, which is timers. And Media Center, I think, is the best example of this that I can think of. You want your machine to be turned off for battery reasons and everything else, but you want it to turn on, you know, a minute before a TV show, get all ready, and then start recording, right? So how do you actually make the box turn on at a particular time? And what that is called a timer. And so you can down to the, I think it's 100 nanosecond level, define it, but you are limited to the current clock resolution. And the clock resolution actually changes through the lifetime of a PC. Right now, the PC will be running a low, as in a big number resolution. It wouldn't be very granular. If I started something like, is Media Player, I think Media Player is a good example, where it will actually change the timer of the box and make it much more fine-grained so that it can
make... Does that burn more battery?
I don't know.
Potentially, yeah, yeah, because there are more timer interrupts.
Yeah.
So, and because it's quite a big difference, I think.
Yeah, it goes to 1 millisecond, I think.
From 17, is it?
From 15.6.
Yeah.
So, but it varies also depending on the Windows version and the app, and I mean there's a lot of different ways to do it.
So,
and that's one, they've actually done optimizations in the newer versions of Windows to prevent setting that clock resolution down to 1 millisecond as much as they can.
There's also
because of that battery life issue.
Mm. One of the things we probably should talk about, and there's a fantastic video. I think it's still the number one video on Channel 9, the Marko Sinovich inside. Windows 7, Windows 2008 to kernel changes. Mm-hmm. One, I mean, it's got like 700,000 hits.
Yeah,
And there's also a case of, well, there's a talk for it at TechEd as well, I think with the same name. And he talks about a thing called timer coalescing, which is a fantastic idea. And the idea is that, let's say we all three of us want to wake up every 100 milliseconds for some reason, right? But you made the call at 23 seconds past the second, and you made it at, we'll round it down, 50, and I made it at, say, 75. Well, with 100 offset, we're going to wake up
three times.
And what they recognized was that most people don't actually care at exactly what millisecond they woke up past a second. They just want to be woken up on a cadence, mm-hmm. right? And so what Windows Timer Coalescing does, and it was introduced in Windows 7, is it recognizes that we can adjust these things, and what it does is we would all be squeezed down into the same window. The timer interrupt would fire once, and then it would actually execute the three work jobs rather than three timers firing at specific times and then firing off three work jobs.
Does it do that in the order that they would have been if it was more granular?
Well, timers aren't really deterministic, are they? I think it's kind of...
Yeah, I don't know if it necessarily will keep the order, but the idea there is that if somebody says, hey, wake me up every 100 milliseconds, they don't really care which 100 millisecond it is. And so, it allows us to save a lot of CPU power because between those 100 millisecond wake-up events, the CPU can go into a low-power state much more often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think the battery saving was huge.
It's quite significant.
Yeah, it was like 30% battery saving was made by that in between Vista and Windows 7 because of that change.
Yeah, yes. If you're using an old laptop with Vista and you were to upgrade it to Windows 7 or even better, Windows 8, you'll see a much better battery life because of those types of optimizations.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised how many timers are out there. I mean, we'll show that in a very sec. There is hundreds of people waking up all the time.
Yeah.
And even if you don't even think about it within your program, within the OS, there's just so much need for it. Let's have a look at the program. So this one's called Timer Hang. And what this guy has done is the same model as before. We've got two events, or two wayable objects, I should say. One's an event for quit that after 30 seconds, the program's going to shut itself down. And the other one, in this case, is what's called a waitable timer. So in the Windows API, there's actually timers and waitable timers. And so all the timers that most people would be aware of is the WM timer event, as in the Windows message event. So that's the one that you'll get received through your message pump. And if you're in like C Sharp and all those languages, you'll actually see it as a function call to you. This is the intrinsic thing that's actually underneath that. Risically, the intrinsic actually just turned into a message that made it a different API manifestation. So what this have done is there's multiple types of timers that you can make, and you can make ones that turn on at a particular time, and Media Center is a good example of that. The other good example is Windows Update, right? You know how it says it? Is it 2 a.m. on Tuesday or something, wherever it is?
Something like that, yeah.
Tuesday.
Yeah, that's how that one fires. It says, at 2 a.m. next Tuesday, wake up. And when you have a timer, you can also decide whether it will or will not resume the box, right? In this case, so that's a specific time one. You also, at the same time, can say it is a periodic timer. So fire it at this time in the future, and then fire every 50 seconds after that for this many times. And so you can have a sequence of events, and that's what this is here. This is running a timer that every 10 seconds fires. Now, there's two ways of treating timers in their own right. You actually can pass a function to the timer call, and it will run the function for you, which means you don't even have to wait for it. It will just start running this code arbitrarily in your process. And behind the scenes, all it's doing is making a thread and scheduling it and running it for you. The other way of doing it is saying, don't worry about the function at all. Just set the waitable object of what it is. So much like semaphores and events, you can wait on a timer.
Wait on it.
All right. And so that's what's happening here. The three worker threads are waiting on the quit event and the work timer. And so when the timer fires, one of them picks it up. And I think in this version, I've wrote this a couple of times in slightly different ways. This is actually going through linear. So it's thread one, thread two, thread three who got it. So it's more of a queue mechanism. I actually wrote this initially without a sleep in the work. And what actually happened was, because of the way the scheduling works in the kernel, because it went round and came up again, it actually was the same thread every time who got scheduled, because he was the most fresh. And because they all were waitable, the first one actually got it. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be a round robin through your threads. It can be more home to one particular thread. So let's have a look at the code. This is one of those ones which it's very code-centric again. We'll take a dump file in the middle again. So when I happened to get it during the work of one thread. And we'll have a look at everybody. The first guy is waiting 30 seconds because he's going to fire the quit event in 30 seconds. Actually, I should have set a timer for the future to set the quit event. It's like, oh well, that would have been a perfect example. But
well, too late now.
Too late now. this guy is waiting. This guy's a worker thread who's waiting. This guy, who was the guy who picked it up, so it wasn't the first thread in the list who picked it up. And then this guy's waiting. So this guy picked up the timer. So he kind of not owns it, but is associated with it right now. So let's have a look at what these guys are waiting on. So we'll do three, because he's waiting. We know that we'll get the array. And I think from memory, from other shows, because in 64-bit on Windows 8, it will be in R13. Here's our two handles, the quit and the thing, and then this number up here, one of those numbers, that one or that one, tells us that there's two in the array. And so we'll go bang handle on the 2C, which I think is the event, which is the quit event. And so what we want is the timer. So once again, the F gives you the name, and unfortunately there's no specific information available. This is where actually we can get a little bit further, and we can run home to the kernel debugger to actually investigate this more. So what we need to do is find this guy in the kernel. All right. So while this is running, I'll set this up so we're ready. What I'm going to do, I could do a live kernel debug for this. What I'm going to do in this case is cross my fingers for timing and do a live KD. We're going to do a mirror dump, and we showed this a couple of weeks ago. And I'm going to save it off to my D drive, which I think my D drive is my SSD. Yep, my D drive is my SSD. And so what we're going to do is we're going to capture this while it's running, the whole box. Where are we? Yep, he's going to still exist, so we'll get live dump right now. So I've caught a live dump of the box. Next week, Chad's going to show how to do this with debugger cables and all the other way of doing it. You get a much better representation because this is a mirror dump and it can be slightly torn. So what we need to do is find that guy, right? And so let's go back to our, this is the guy. So everything has when it has a name, everything is much easier.
Right.
So let's grab this work timer name. And I'll show you how to do it the hard way as well. So there's a command, bang object. So everything made by the object manager has this standard header, an object header. And one of the things you can do is you can open it by name. Don't put quotes around it. It has to be fully qualified. And what this will do is go through the dump file and find the object of that name. And fingers crossed if it works. We'll come back with the address. And so this is the address, this is the pointer in the kernel. You notice it has lots of Fs on the front, which is an indication that you're in kernel mode. Once again, you see these high pointer numbers and handle counts and stuff like that, and you get its name. The directory object. So the directory object is the folder that it's in, and so it's actually this...
Base named object.
It's not a directory, is it? It's a... container.
It's an object directory. It's not a file directory like we'd think of it in a file system.
Yeah, it's like it's this folder right here. Yeah. So if I did bang object on that, it will show me everybody. Whoops. It will show me everybody who's within it.
Right.
So there's a lot. Thinking. You notice the numbers on the front? So it's actually it's a table of linked lists. And so at position like 20 is scrolling by, there was four guys in it. So how many slots? I think kernel uses 512 slots a lot. And then, well, it must be, there's 36 slots right now. And then it has a linked list forward. So so what we need to do is find out more information. This is the guy we found, and this is the address of the guy we found. So the intent here is to find out what this timer is really about, when it's going to fire, whether it's going to fire multiple times, and we also can also find out who's waiting on it, right, across the whole OS. Objects are waitable across anybody who can access them. It doesn't have to be within the same process, right? And so we can get that information. So the commands we've learned today is bang object. You can search by name, which is what I did here, and you can search by its pointer address. As I said, if it happens to be a directory object, it will enumerate the guys underneath you. And if I did a search down here, I can do that. I will find, there is, the timer object in slot 14. Okay. So what we want to do is find this guy. Now, there is a command called bang timer. And this is where we're going to have a bit of a theory about what timers are and how they work. What we've got in the kernel is a 512 node table. And every single position in the table represents a millisecond past the origin of time, right? And you'll notice here that we have the concept of interrupt time, right? Interrupt time is the lowest granularity that we have, so it's the resolution that lowest resolution you can get to. And you know, when you set your clock in the BIOS, that's really where you're setting the origin of this from. What this table has is a one offset all the way down the table. So if I happen to ask for 20 milliseconds past the origin of time, then it'll be in slot 20. And so it's time divided by 512, and then the modulus of that, and then you'll get your position. So if I want something at say 5 and 517, they're actually both resolved down to 5, and so what you end up with is in slot 5 a linked list of everybody who wants to be at 5. All right. So don't think of it as milliseconds past 1 second, because it only goes up to 512. It's milliseconds past the origin of time divided by 512 into a modulus into a linked list. You know, we make everything simple in the kernel.
Of course.
So it makes sense to programmers.
It does. And quite frankly, nobody needs to know about this stuff. So what we have across here is this is the object, so the same thing we did with bang object before. P is periodic, and I'll get back to that in a sec. This is the interrupt time it will fire at, which is comparative to this guy. I've never understood what this one is with the low high, but anyway.
Yeah, sure.
This is the bugger, bless it, has given us a better indication of what this is. So you'll see that this one on slot 4, right? They both have the same resolution, but one of them is at 45 past, and it's currently within 800 milliseconds of that right now. And this guy wants to be woken up 12 seconds later-ish. So even though you're in the same slot, it doesn't mean that you'll wake up at the same time. It just means that you're divided and spread out more evenly. And this is what time and coalescence was. Time and coalescence moved people from these individual slots and puts it in a slot next to it and coalesces them together. So when the number 5 interrupt fires at that time, then all this massive linked list of guys get processed, right? And so you'll see bigger buckets as you move into Windows 7 and Windows 8 comparative to Windows Vista and below. And then on the end, you've got what's actually going to happen. And so there's two things that can happen. You can either release someone from a wait, and this is where we have to do a bit more theory as well, and then we also can fire a DPC. And this table is actually called the DPC timer table. There's two types of DPCs. There's regular DPCs, and there is timer DPCs. A DPC is a deferred procedure call. And what you can think of it as is the worker of the work threads or the work jobs of the kernel. An interrupt comes in, and when interrupts fire, it risically halts the whole box. It's not going to think about anything else. So it's really, really important that the interrupt come in, finish, and get out of there. But you don't want to actually do any work, right? Because that's expensive. And so what it does is it queues work. And it can queue DPC, it queues regular DPCs, right? The other thing that, so that's like work objects of the kernel. The other thing that you want to do is some things just need to wake up and ask repeatedly off the hardware. So that's a lot more, interrupts is more like inbound. If you've got outbound, and classic example of that is USB. USB is a polling protocol. Every N, whatever it is, it polls the USB bus and says, anybody got any data out there? Stuff like that. And so that's what all these DPCs are in here. They're the work jobs of the kernel. Instead of an interrupt coming in and making a DPC and just scheduling it, the timer is waking up every time between every thread is scheduled, the DPC timer table is checked. If anybody's expired, the DPC runs instead of a program running.
And it's still an interrupt. It's just rather than a piece of hardware signaling the interrupt, it's a timer. It's the timer hardware actually signaling the interrupt.
Yeah. And so you have all these, so anything that has a function name, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing DPC timer routines in the kernel. All these other ones that says thread, that's every single wait for a single object and all of those. So if you go down here, there is a lot. And so when we said that you will see a lot of events in the kernel, this is how many there are, and this is how prevalent it's used. This is how you wake someone up at a certain time. So all these guys are all waiting on timer events, all right? This is not what wakes up a like an event or a semaphore. So in here is our object, And who's going to be waiting on it is our thread. And so actually our thread, who the kernel object that represents our thread in user mode, is this number right here, right? And so what you can do is, when we did the bang object before, takes a little while to run through the table, you can find it again. What we can do is just put bang timer and put it on the end. Right, it doesn't take the name, it just takes the, and that's found the single one in there. So here's the same object that we just found. It's a periodic timer. So you know how it's waking up every, what was it, 10 seconds or 5 seconds or whatever it was? That's what indicates. It says, when this thing fires, reschedule it again for the cadence of the timer. The next time it's going to wake up is at this specific time, and then, as I said, it will add 5 seconds to that for the next run around. And then, who are you going to wake up? And in this case, there's 3 threads waiting on it. Whoops. And so one of these 3 will be woken up, all right? And so if we grab that number and use bang thread, whoops, that's not very good. There we go. And the magic number is 17. So 7 is show all the bottom bits of data. I don't know, there is no F bit, as in bit 8. But 10 is resolve user mode symbols. And I was actually wrong. Weeks ago, I said, if you want to resolve symbols in the kernel, you can do slash u. Well, slash u is unload. You were right. It is slash user. I looked it up afterwards.
Oh,
so
right.
I was completely wrong. what 17 does is exactly the same as you changing to the thread and doing what, not slash u, which is unload, slash user is what Chad said. And it does it real time right now. So much like mem usage and VM and all those, where you remember the magic number at the end, the magic number for thread is 17. And so we do a 17 on here, and it says, lo and behold, it came from timer hang. I hope it did.
Go figure.
And it has been waiting for 20 seconds. So that timer has been firing every 10 seconds, but this guy has never been released, right? He hasn't had a chance. So if we look at one of the other ones, we'll find that he will have a lower number. He has been waiting for 10 seconds. So he got scheduled. Yeah, he's also, this must be the third guy. He's got it. Where is it? I'm scrolling past it. Yeah. There it is, right there. If you guys debug for a living, go to your manager, plead, beg, whatever you have to do, but get a whopping big widescreen monitor. Because 64-bit debugging on something that's narrow like this is
a lot of scrolling.
Yeah, it's just bad.
Or you set the font size really small and squint a lot.
Yeah. And so this is the guy who's been waiting the least. So this guy was the guy who's got scheduled last and then went around the loop and is now waiting. So he's been waiting for 9.21 seconds at this point. 0.921 seconds. And because we put 17 on the end... Oh, this is a live dump. I did. So this, I was hoping to show the stack all the way into my program, but this is the kernel dump. I didn't take a full dump.
Oh.
If I live debugged the box, which is obviously a full, or if I'd crashed the box, which is like control scroll scroll or not my fault, and got a full, then I would have seen the user stack. But because this is a kernel one, we stop at the boundary. And this actually you can give away of actually the internals of what wait for mob objects really is. I call wait for mob objects in the user mode, and then if you actually look at the dump file, if we look at the current register where we are at, we're at a ret, and if we unassemble backwards UB from the current 64-bit instruction pointer, we are in a syscall. So what it's done is it's called into the kernel, which is what syscall is, and we're calling function 59, which must be wait for mobile objects. And when that comes back, leave the function, and you know that you've got the event fired, right? And then within my address space, data would be populated, so like the return code and stuff like that. The kernel would have written that into the user mode address space. There's no real code here in the user space that stops you executing, right? There's nothing that goes stop. And you can actually see how it works in the kernel following the rest of the stack. So here's what's called the system service copy and, which is the program that accepts all syscalls, it validates all the data and makes sure that nothing going through that user mode, kernel mode boundary is doing something malicious. Like if you're passing 59, you know, for wait for mob objects, you know, these rules must apply. You know, good pointer here, within these bounds here. And then you can actually go into the kernel's wait for mob object implementation. And what actually happens is it sets up all the structures in the kernel saying, I care about this event, and you know, I'm going to subscribe to the timer table and all this other stuff. And then it hits this swap context. And what that says is, I'm going to change the state of this thread from running to waitable. And so until that status of the thread object, and it all comes down to a structure. And so where's my thread? There's my thread. And actually, you can see right here what it's waiting on. It's the bang thread command actually will show you the two fundamentals that it's actually waiting on. So it's called a notification event for events and synchronization timer for timers. If we actually, is it K3 without an underscore?
Try it. I think it's underscore.
This is the fundamental data structure that everything is based on. So we talked about this very briefly in an old show. In user mode, you just run, and you don't know of anything else but yourself, right? You don't know about anybody else's memory, and you don't know about anybody else's threads. In the kernel, threads are just data, right? They run because the main CPU threads decree that you should run, and nothing more, right? And you have to really think about, when you're kernel debugging, to treat things as data, don't treat them as runnable objects. This thread object, this structure in memory, is the only reason why it runs or doesn't run. And the status in here, which I won't bother finding, says you are now in a waitable state. Until that one line changes from waitable to running, it will never get scheduled. So it will never pick up those registers, inject them into the CPU, and then let you run as if you had complete control of the box. And that's what the timer code does. The DPC timer code sees that this line of timer is expired. It then goes, all right, I'm going to choose one of these threads, and it's a queue, so it's going to choose the front one. And then all it's going to do is going to populate a couple of timer-centric pieces of data, like the return codes and stuff. And then it's just going to change the status from wait to running.
Ready.
Oh, ready, sorry. And then the scheduler will move it from ready to running. And then that's the process of moving it from the memory to actually into the CPU and actually doing something. And so what's happened in the thread is it was walking along, and then it gets to the point and it goes, all right, I don't need to run anymore because I'm now waiting, and it runs an instruction called yield, a function called yield. And then it goes, okay, I don't need to run anymore, and just stops the CPU dead. It sucks it out of the CPU, stores it away in memory as data, and then until this waitable object comes along and turns it into ready then running, that data comes back and then continues on. So it actually executes the very next line of code, but never knew that it stopped. Absolutely no different for you than you being just scheduled out because it's not your turn. When the interrupts fire saying it's someone else's turn to run, it grabs the CPU, no matter what line you're at, and then rips it out, puts it into data, and then gets someone else and puts it in the CPU. And that's how multitasking works. And so that's what you're seeing here. As I said, you see on the stack, it goes into wait for mob objects, it sets up all the data structures, and then just says stop. And then when the event fires, it's released and continues on its merry way, doing whatever it wants to do. And that's how you can work out what's going on. And so if we actually look at the timer itself, as I said, what it all comes down to, and I'll do a clear screen so it's more obvious. This is what you need to work out. You need to say, okay, this is the exact time that is going to fire next. This is the current time, so it's scheduled to fire in 60-ish milliseconds, and one of these threads will be released. And so if you go look at all these guys...
Longer than that, it's 49. So 49,
yeah.
4 seconds.
Yeah. And so, as I said, if we look at this thread, any of those threads, you can see the objects it's waiting on, that will satisfy it, and then how long it's been sitting there waiting and stuff like that.
And did you want to talk about whether or not it can wake up the machine from sleep?
Ah, yes, thank you. I forgot about that. I even have it on my desktop. So how is the hardware doing all this, right? It all comes down to this thing. So when you trigger the, configure the timer in the DPC timer table, it all comes down to this Boolean right at the end, right? And if you pass in true, it will actually allow this timer, it registers the timer as both a DPC timer, like a normal software timer, but also as a hardware timer. So when we go down to, is it S3 we support this in?
S3, I believe S4.
Yeah. So there's these power states. And so we're running S0 at the moment, which means we're on. And then it's the level of sleep that you go to. And like shutdown is S6?
Shutdown, completely powered off, is S5. Yeah. And no timers will ever wake you up from there. But from S4, which is a hibernate, and S3, which is a standby, we still will program the timer chip on the motherboard to allow us to wake back up.
So it will literally, it knows how in the firmware, and this is the ACPI spec, it knows how to fire an internal, is it an interrupt for itself, into the ACPI chip. We're not talking about the CPU here, we're talking about other chips on the motherboard. Mm-hmm. And it knows how to accept that at a certain time, knows that that's important, to change the power management, turn the CPU power on, turn the bus power on, all those other things, and then start the system up and then invoke a timer that does the work.
So that's one of the things that happens when we go from a running S0 power state into a standby or a hibernate, is we'll check the timers, look at which ones have that resume flag set, and we'll go program the ACPI timer chips to wake us up at the next appropriate time.
So if you have a box which is in that state and you just ran out of battery, well, it's not going to resume, obviously. It's just going to all flush out, and that memory in the motherboard is just going to go. It's not a persistible thing. It's not like you're writing it to flash. You're writing it to volatile memory on the motherboard. So that's how that works. And so if you ever wonder how, sometimes you sit in your bed in the middle of the night and hear this fan going, well, that's what happened. Nobody's downstairs turning your PC on.
Yeah.
It's these wakeable timers. And there is a command, and I have no idea how this works. I'm going to have to look up the command line. Power CFG.
PW.
Last wake. Here it is. Oh, the wake timers. There it is. It will list them for you. So you can power CFG, and then last wake will tell you why you turned on last, to work out, okay, which of the wakeable timers is the one that turned you on. And as I said, wake timers lists the people who will wake you up. So if I had Media Center on this, like particularly I would at home.
Schedule a TV show and you'll see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a laptop in my bedroom that seems to turn on in the middle of the night.
Well, that'll be the Windows Update one, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
It's scheduled to wake you up.
And it's every night, so... I'll check it out. I'll find out.
Check it out with that app.
Well, that will tell you what they are. It's as simple as that.
Cool.
And I think there's event logs as well that will tell you roughly the same information. Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Yeah, I'm not an expert at that. So, that's the end for weightable objects. We've kind of gone through the whole gamut of reasons why things actually aren't doing much when that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
And all the different ways that programmers can address it. There's more weightable objects, we're not here to be a development thing, really. We're here just to tell you how to troubleshoot. Yes, you can wait in registry keys and files and lots of other things as well. It all comes down to the same logic. It's going to be an array of handles. Look at the bang handle. The user mode debugger has zero other extensions for this. So if bang handle doesn't satisfy you, that's really it. You can always fall back to kernel mode like we did today for timers to find out more information. There is commands in the kernel debugger to drill into particular object types better. And so you can, in this case, find out what time this thing is going to be resolved. So actually, one of the ones I was going to show you, which is kind of cool, just as a good way of finishing the day, there is a one in here. Where is it? At 1 millisecond past the new century, we have a DPC called the Century DPC routine. And so there's some of these ones where you go, that's a long way out. Well, at some point,
Just in case you haven't rebooted before then.
Yeah. And I don't know what this Sentry DPC routine does, but obviously it does something that makes sure that the Sentry processing is done as soon as time ticks over on
the Y2K prevention routine.
Yeah.
The Y2K 0.1, I think.
So there's a couple of ones that are in a, you know, absolutely long way out.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other ones.
Yeah, I'm going to miss that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah. There's a 2014 one.
Some kind of an idle timeout.
That's, I don't know why in, what's that?
Power POP.
17 it's, months from now.
It has something to do with the power management.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Someone thinks it's important.
Nice.
That's interesting, your side tidbit. There's an interesting time, isn't there?
Yeah.
Cool.
That's the end of the show.
And that is the show for this week. If you have questions, you can leave comments in the show notes, and we will get back to you there. Or you can email us at defragtools@microsoft.com. See you next week.
Have a good week.
Bye.